G'day guys, welcome to another episode. Before we get too far into it, could you please like, subscribe, share, comment, literally anything that you can do. It'll help out a lot. Thank you. All right, welcome back to another episode. Today we're sitting here with Ben Horstman, who is the owner of Consolidated Plant Services, also known as CPS. Tell us what you do, Ben.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Off we go.
Owner of CPS. We do mobile plant inspections and risk assessments, all in the pursuit of eliminating compliance-related downtime.
You've worked on that before. I like it. However, I think you sell yourself a little bit short because you are probably one of the most successful in the field in Victoria. I have no problem with saying that, and possibly even Australia. I don't know too much about some of the other states, but I'm sure there's some big dogs out there. However, you have definitely changed the game in what compliance is around mobile plant, at least in my mind. To give a bit of a pathway for you to take off from.
Yep.
When I started in digging holes, I could get a risk assessment at 9 p.m. written on the back of a napkin,
yep,
which was compliant.
Yep.
And would be accepted at 6 a.m. the next day.
Yep.
CPS had a part of changing that and making it so that the plan actually matches what the risk assessment says, I think, is one of the major things.
That is one of the major things. So the concept being is the back of it is performance-based legislation where we don't care how you get there. You just have to make sure that shit doesn't hurt people, basically. And
yep,
there's a whole heap of hidden risks, I suppose, that we as fitters knew that existed, and we knew the failure points. And we saw things coming in the door that weren't right, that weren't accurate. And, you know, the original reason why we set up the business was to help subbies be able to interface into projects better, to reduce mobilisation downtime, to get it right, whether that was helping them create service reports or structure or just getting the basics right. And then it sort of went a bit of a sideways skew when we came to Victoria and we saw that people were getting risk assessments on the back of beer coasters.
At 9 p.m. at night that were compliant, and you could bring your jalopy to work the next day,
yep,
and they'd go, beautiful risk assessment that's a carbon copy of every other risk assessment,
yep,
nothing specific to the machine apart from its serial number.
Yep. You've definitely got a quick hitch on your tip truck, and you've definitely got a reverse camera on,
yep,
your helicopter.
Yep, hell yeah, you do. So we'll start off because you have we've spoken for a long time.
Yep.
Me and you. You have an interesting story, which when people hear, I think it might change a little bit of the perspective of where you come from, because it's not once, but at least 10 times I've heard fuck CPS on the job when you've had, you know, your QR code have to be scanned and it starts to not work and everything else like that. However, tell us where you came from, what your story is.
How far back do you want to go?
Well, wherever you want to go to, like, you know, when you're kicking and screaming at 2 a.m., you know, nah, not really.
Nah.
The mines, I think it was the start.
Started off, very, very start of the journey was dad was a diesel mechanic and owned a heap of equipment, and I owned old gear. So he bought his first dozer when I was five. He bought an old D9H with about 50,000 hours on it.
Sick.
So from the beginning.
You have a cab? No cab.
I had a cab, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, even had air conditioning as well.
Oh, wow.
Didn't have a transmission at the time when he bought it.
Creature comfort, you know what? Don't need a cab, do need a transmission.
Do need a transmission. Mm. So then he bought a heap of other gear after that, but it was always upwards of 40,000 hours. And our, you know, my brother and I and whatnot, our time, our childhood was basically there helping dad to keep these things going. So we got a good understanding of how to run high hour equipment on a budget. And it can be done, which is probably a really good thing to understand, is that there's not an issue with new gear. And to be some extent, we don't have an issue with newer gear. But, from there, did an apprenticeship with Caterpillar dealer. From there, wasn't a particularly good apprentice, did a heap of jobs, drove trucks for a bit, went to Western Australia, went overseas, worked in Scotland for a while, came back to West Australia, went to New South Wales, so worked in iron ore, mineral sands, Then went to Central Asia, worked in country called Kyrgyzstan for a couple of years in a gold mine.
Yeah, that's actually a really great story, you know, talking to people about, because I remember we've on some of our conversations, it gets freezing there.
Fucking cold, man.
Yeah, like minus, what did you tell me? It was like 30 or 40 or some bullshit number.
It got down to sort of minus 40, 45.
But so what was it? Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan. Oh. So right on the eastern border of Kyrgyzstan and China. So interesting thing, pretty high altitude. So 4,600 metres above sea level, so which is 17,000 feet, I reckon. So working at 80% of atmospheric pressure as well. So little things that happen. So water boiled at 80 degrees. You'd have, you know, you'd open a tin of coffee.
Sick.
Coffee goes everywhere. Bread doesn't rise because you get done. There's not enough oxygen to set the yeast off. You can't microwave your mac and cheese because water boils at 80 degrees. And you had a lot of issues with trucks, like off-highway trucks and altitude derates and that sort of thing. So, again, on the back of
managing. What, from not enough air through the – so they need – so with the combustion, it wouldn't combust properly with – with lower density of air, just in case anyone thought I was a dickhead or
that's a thing.
Picked it up, yeah.
Yep,
still a dickhead.
So
how long were you there?
Just short of 2 years.
That's actually when we started talking. I think I uploaded a photo when I was over in the real western part of China. You know, and I uploaded a photo when you are like, what the fuck are you doing there? Like, I was only few hundred k's away from there, I think.
You were. And the interesting thing is Kyrgyzstan's a whole heap easier to get to than where you were in Western China.
Yeah.
That's like...
Yeah, we ended up having an interesting story. I won't hijack it too much because we're on the CPS train. But, yeah, had a friend who got me some permits over there, which were almost impossible for Westerners to get.
Yep.
Ended up having one of the most interesting but difficult holidays ever because... a guy who looks like me should not be there. Like, they do not want me there.
A few double takes.
They followed me around. Police followed us one day 400 k's.
Really?
Like, we took off from a town and they obviously, whatever was happening with, you know, that region, they followed us because they didn't want us to go and see different things. And so it was confronting. It was a difficult holiday but beautiful, strange landscape, things that you've never heard of that should be in National Geographics and stuff. Like, the landscape is incredible. The people are so lovely.
Yeah.
The food is actually quite good. I don't know what Kyrgyzstan was like, if it was just camp food, but you must have travelled around there a little bit.
Camp food was okay. Local food was... Some of it was okay. They liked interesting things.
Man, they bought out a whole lamb that had been deep fried at dinner. Like, the whole, like, it wasn't even a lamb. I reckon, like, I don't know, some sort of sheep. They bought it out, and then two people on the table reached out with their chopstick, pulls the eyes out, and then smacked them in, and I'm sitting there going... And then someone reached out and starts pulling the cheek meat, and the head was done before the whole rest of it, like...
similar sort of thing, but they'd get a 44, so you cut a 40, half 44 and a half. Onions, potatoes, every bit of the lamb in there, boiled. Salt, pepper and dill.
Beautiful. Just what we wanted. Might get a bit of organs in there.
The whole lot.
Yeah.
The whole lot. Skin and all.
So then, okay, we'll get back to the CPS trade. So then you're over there, you're obviously... Learn a little bit about the, you know, the mining safety is the highest level of safety, I believe, because it's such a, it's an environment which can be controlled. You know, it doesn't always end up that way.
Theoretically, over there, no rules.
Really?
None. So they had like a, kind of like a take five thing, but their trucks didn't even have isolators on them. So they had no lockout, tagout procedures. Like, I remember being in a 9350 shovel, cleaning what they call a contamination sensor out, so 400-ton Liebherr face shovel, in the pump room, pulling a contamination sensor out. So you pull it out, you put your finger over the hole, clean the metal off of it, and then I hear the pre-lube start. Wait for this thing to start. Trying to get it back in. Don't start it. I'm in here.
Yeah, good.
And that was...
Yeah, your tolos really worked well there.
You really had your five senses, you know. But then there was things that didn't happen. And although we had a lot of trucks, I think it was 135 between 777s, 85s, 89s, and we had very few fuck-ups.
Yeah.
And it's because everybody was aware that any point in time something could go wrong.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't uncommon. And I don't agree with this. I don't think it was a good thing. But one day I'm in the ute with one of the local mechanics. There's a 789 going up the ramp, loaded. There's a 785 overtaking the 789. And then there's a 777 with two wheels on the wind row overtaking both of them at the same time.
There's some production there.
Yep.
The high levels of production there. They're moving some, what were they digging out?
Gold.
Well, fuck, with that sort of behaviour
happening. Under a moving glacier.
Under a moving glacier.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's why they had to go so fast, you see, because the glacier's moving.
Well, it was.
Yeah, and it's taking the gold with it.
It was. They got a tiny little ore body and they just got these glaciers that are tipping into it. So you're not moving overburden and then it's back there tomorrow. And in summer it was moving up to, I think, 70 mil an hour.
Jesus.
So, 70 mil a day. It was a lot.
Whatever it is, 70 mil an hour or a day, it ends up being a lot. Yep. But, okay, so you finish over there in the middle of nowhere,
yep.
Come back here, and then what happens?
Come back here to Adelaide. I'm originally from Adelaide.
That's why I don't like you.
Yep. Yeah. Don't blame you. sing out to a mate who did my apprenticeship with, hey, mate, you need a hand with anything? I've come back. I actually came back because I burnt my leg. It's another side story, but burn my leg, couldn't go back to altitude because things don't heal.
Mm.
So I'm just going to have 2 months to, you know, work out what I'm going to do, whether I'm going to go back there. Hey, Alex, do you need a hand? Yeah, mate. Can you give us a hand 1 day a week? 2 days later, he's given me a ute and booked me 5 days a week work. And I was like, yeah, okay. Ended up at Cooper Petey working for, I think it might have been Macca, Mining Civil Australia, doing some subbing work for them. Going, I come back to escape this FIFO game. What the fuck am I doing back here?
Mm.
And then I met another fella and he said, hey, he was going to hire a dozer for my old man and I knew him from a few other channels. He's like, hey, I've got this job on the north coast of New South Wales. It's in construction. It's a shit job. It's going to be inspecting machinery, but you'll get your 5 days a week. You won't have to do FIFO and it's not a bad part of the world to live in. You earn all right money doing it. And I was like, fuck it, I'll give it a go.
Hell yeah, you had been when you called it a shit job.
So I'll cruise up there and then keeping in mind that Dad did what he did, being in mining, so understood the good, then went over to Kyrgyzstan, understood the extreme other limit of it and what you could get away with, but was still good reliability aspect of it. Going there and seeing it all come together under this fella, Luke, who's a hell of a gentleman. And it's like, hang on a minute, there's a bit of bigger picture stuff here. Like there's a lot of people that can do good out of this. Mm. And then so obviously all these subbies turned up, not so dissimilar to the people that we grew up with, and I'm wanting to help them.
Mm.
There's not enough hours in the day. Job finishes, it's like, okay, sweet. All I'm going to do is try and set up a business so that I can stay living there because it's a pretty good part of the world, helping these guys. But major oversight, some people don't want to be helped.
Small issue, yeah.
Why the fuck would I want to pay you to come and tell me what's wrong with my gear? Do you know who I am? Do you know how good I am?
I'm pretty sure I've rung you up and said that, haven't I?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, or something similar lines.
Something similar, I might have missed
on a few sections, yep, of it, though. So, because that's where you really get into it, because you've taken... you know, everyone who's listening or, you know, I don't know, not everyone, but some of the people who's listening, send a machine to a job.
Yep.
They send a compliant-ish machine.
Yep.
Everyone sent one with a bolt missing.
Yep.
Everyone sent one with, you know, tracks that probably need replacing but have a bit of life left if you close one eye and go, yeah. Your job is to make sure that you're in between that and the project and make sure that everything's safe.
Yes.
And not going to, in 1 week, those tracks need to be replaced.
Yep.
And then the project is you know, put a dozer onto the job, expecting that to produce
X amount,
and then in 1 week, it's now got to go down because it needs new chains.
That's right.
And that's probably the simple business model that you have. Yep. And you sell it to guys like me by saying, hang on, I can help you out with your forecasting and make sure that the machines are up to scratch. So when you go to a project, you hit the ground running.
Yep.
We'll do the hurt at the beginning rather than the hurt at the end.
Take the pain early.
Yep, take the pain early. And for the project, they can be certain if they come to CPS that the machines that come to site aren't going to need new chains in a week.
That's the general context.
Concept. That's on your capability statement, line two, just said by Starbuck.
Yep, done.
How's it working?
Good.
Does it work well?
It works good. There's a lot of challenges with it, and we've refined it over the years. But what we're finding is we call them big wins, but they really translate to people as hidden risks.
Mm-hmm.
And hidden risks are things that can have massive impact to people that they have absolutely no clue that exist between the manufacturer, between the people that are running it, between the operators. Everybody thinks that this can never happen. And after a period of time with the amount of gear that we look at and we see hidden trends and we go, this can be a problem and these are the reasons why it can be a problem.
I know that one of them, a fair while ago, I got an emergency call that I had to be put onto one of the systems that you help out with.
Yep.
An emergency call, hi, we need this machine. Now, that machine wasn't available.
Yep.
For most others, it was during COVID, I think, and I just had some sitting in the yard ready to rock and roll. Your guys came out there. The list of things meant that the job was going to be a two-week-long job.
Yep.
I was going to get, let's say, I pulled 10 grand out of it for me, you know, because maybe got them a bit on the rate. And but then you needed five of it to get it ready in 2 days and it was just all too much of a fuckery. Yeah. So we didn't end up going on. Now, isn't that, on one hand, I lost 2 week long, you know, 12-hour a day job, which is shit. But on the other hand, the reason you did it is because you actually found a problem. I think it was with the top end of the motor and the DPF. I think you'd checked that.
Okay.
And then it ended up popping a DPF about 500 hours later.
Really?
Yeah, it did, which, like, of course I never ring you and tell you that that's a good thing, but I'm pretty sure that the report came back something along the lines of you've got some regen issues, you know, it's throwing a code and blah, 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 blah. And what do you do when it throws code on a regen? Isolate it, start it again, the code goes away and off we run.
Yep.
Well, we did that one too many times and the DPF blocked up.
Gotcha. Expensive.
DPF's a shit.
But,
okay, so one other thing I wanted to talk about is you're actually a guy who has some Chinese equipment experience. Not only from going and working away over there, but you guys deal with some mines here, I believe, and have done some contract work to head over and have a look at their compliance and everything else.
We were engaged by one manufacturer on behalf of some of their clients to basically give an impartial opinion as to will this do what we need it to do.
Really interesting for me, because that's the same sort of thing that I went over there to go see.
Yep.
My first trip, a couple of trips before me and you started really speaking, and I came at it from the perspective of will this dig a hole. You're also coming at it from them, but you add another part onto it safely. Will it dig a hole safely and can we, I suppose, train and put people on it to make sure that we're the uptime and everything? Is that what you were looking at?
It come back to more of a marketing thing and people probably scratch their head at that a little bit. But if we're going to look at something and we're going to put our name anywhere near it, then it needs to do what people believe it's going to do, not what the book says it's going to do.
Is that in terms of weight? Is that in terms of, you know, it's like runtime, uptime, productivity?
It's productivity. So if you've got an established relationship with a brand that does X and you're going to go to somewhere else, it has to equal at least what you're currently doing.
Does it though? Interesting question.
I think so.
Or can it be less than? Because
it depends. There's a couple of different dimensions of it. You know, it depends on how long you want to have it for.
Yeah, and it also depends on how many of them you have to have. So if you have, let's say, a current brand that you have X amount of capital invested
yep.
to move Y amount of dirt,
yep.
if it's X minus 25% and it's Y minus 2%, it might be okay.
That's
depending
right.
on what you're moving. Now, Mr. Goldmine wants to move as much ore through that processing facility because so he does not care about what he has to spend at the front.
That's right.
As long as he can keep that mill running at 100% capacity.
Yep.
For me, on the other hand, I have a downtime every single day waiting for trucks.
Yep.
There is no time with Melbourne's traffic that I can keep the amount of trucks up to the digger's production value.
Yep.
Which means that I can have a slightly reduced production value and it doesn't really matter. I just have to keep the operator off of Facebook and I pick that up. Or, you know, which is real hard considering as though I sit down and put my face all over Facebook and Starbucks is a company.
You're exactly right in what you're saying. And I suppose people look at a machine and they go, a digger must do this, but there's so many different variables to it,
yeah.
you know. And so a bit of a methodology that we have when we look at equipment for when people are purchasing it is what's your intention with it and what's the cost of prevention versus the cost of cure? And I'll give you an example. We got two people at either end of the spectrum. We ran a pretty cool project about 5 or 6 years ago. Oil companies bought 50 bits of gear from a dealer, secondhand bits of gear from a dealer here in Victoria, or they've sourced it to go to Papua New Guinea. Needs to be tier 3 or below engine, so it's all secondhand gear, but we want to have what they said reasonable reliability. Well, what does that look like? And then once we went through it, gear has to do 2,000 hours a year for 2 years, so I want to get 4,000 hours out of it. Then we got to consider what's going to happen in that 4,000 hours. If a dozer's got 13,000 hours on it, you're going to exceed that 15,000 hour component life.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have the infrastructure to replace that over there?
No.
So then you start throwing money at things before they've reached their component life here, or items here.
The cost analysis says that maybe you should dump another 100 grand into the dozer and buy one with 9,000 hours.
It's easier paying for it in Melbourne than it is up the top of a hill.
Why are they getting it from Melbourne? That's stupidity. Get it from at least Queensland. Like one of the biggest dealers one of the biggest cat dealers in the world is in Queensland.
Those things, yeah.
You know? But yet, I don't know. But
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how it came to be. It was a very strange
two-minute question. But interesting that relationship that you look at.
And on the other end of the spectrum, you've got a farmer that rings up and go, hey, can you go down to Richie's and have a look at a backhoe that's got 15,000 hours on it and it's got 100 things wrong with it? And you go, how many hours are you going to do with it a year? They go, 50. What happens if the machine doesn't work? Oh, we'll use a John Deere. So it doesn't really matter if it breaks down.
Yeah.
The price is right. And you've got to keep that sliding scale with it too. And the same method applies to what you're doing too. You know, like spending the time running an asset like a production asset at 8,000 hours a year, this doesn't happen. There's too many easy wins that you get or easy losses that you get that offset the cost of actually trying to run it like a perfect machine.
You just sit there and you just watch the money burn, the ring road clags, and then you, instead of having $200,000 sitting waiting to load trucks, you got $400,000 sitting to load trucks.
Yep.
And then when the truck rocks up, $400,000 asset might do it in 1 minute and 15 seconds and the $200,000 asset does it in 1 minute and 25 seconds. And the 10 seconds doesn't mean shit because it's one red traffic light that you're going to get.
That's exactly right.
You know, or it's like I always lean back to, it's one scroll on TikTok, which is, you know, and it's really a challenge to talk about because it is so prevalent in everyone's lives, you know. Yeah. Like, but, you know, if they sit down and the truck pulls up and they finish typing a text message and then load the truck, well, that's the difference there.
Yeah.
However, the office is constantly texting them with updates and shit anyway.
That's
so
right.
We're making the rod for our own back.
So the only real time that then comes into play is where your reputation is hanging on it. So you might have a machine that 10% of the time, if it doesn't work, can cause you a real problem.
Hell yeah.
And that's where you want to have your $400,000 machine. not your $200,000
two of the $200,000 machines there, but then that's they right. end up costing you $400,000, yep. which is a – I actually went for a quote for a – oh, well, it's more than a quote – and I said that I would have a spare size of every band, like every banding and machine.
Okay.
5 to 10 ton.
Yeah.
10 to 20 ton. 20 to 35 ton. I'll have a spare yep. available. But I get to use Chinese equipment, which I haven't actually had a problem with. Everyone knows I'm, you know, quite happy with it so far. But of course, like the highest ones only got sort of 4,000 or 5,000 hours, I think it is. You know.
That's still a good run though. And how many people like? How many people buy new gear now in certain environments that are going to keep it for longer than that?
Very true. I have a mate of mine who trades in between 4,000 to 6,000 hours, and sometimes he gets an outlier early where the dealer rings him up and says, oi, we got a guy who's looking for a 2,000-hour machine. Bring it down, trade it in, switch it over, and we'll give you a new one with a little bit of equity in it. Works well.
Yep.
I think it's got four... I don't know. I was checking up on it a few weeks ago. I can't quite remember the number, but I've got about 4,000 hours on one.
Gotcha.
And haven't ran into too many dramas. Their servicing is actually quite you have to service them a lot.
Yes.
Like you know, more than some other brands.
Is that a bad thing, though?
Well, it can be.
Okay.
It can be. The downtime, because the servicing, you only have, you know, 1 week, let's say, to get it done, you know, before it turns from 500 hours to 550 hours, and now you're 10% of your service schedule out, which is annoying, you know. Yeah. So you got 1 week in between 480 or 90 to 520, 30, yeah. somewhere there. It can be a bit, especially when you start to run more than a handful of them.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that some of them are 250 hours instead. However, we've had a comparative amount of downtime or less than with them. They are serviced a lot, and in which case, if the service guys are any good, when they rock up, they look over the machine, they're finding some problems, they're testing some oils, you know. Of course, maybe the cost is a little bit more expensive per hour, you know, when you work out your numbers for your servicing, but you're saving it at the start. It's probably your interest savings or something.
Yeah.
Really, it's just one of the things, one of the many things you have to look at when buying a machine. It's not as easy as just...
There's a formula that spits out as to what's the cheapest way to move dirt.
Yeah.
And it depends if you're going to keep the machine for 5,000 hours, you're going to keep it for 10,000 hours.
Or 20. Or like 20. Your old boy, buy them at 40,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. I reckon it'd still be going as well.
You're still going.
Is it really? A
couple of them are still going, yeah. They don't do any work, but...
But you could get them started?
They could go to work.
Fuck, would your moisturised hands be able to, you know, fill them up with diesel?
Probably wouldn't. I'd get bloody, what do they call it? Dermatitis.
Actually, that's what happens to me when I touch diesel or hydraulic oil.
Happens to the best.
I was filling up a motorbike yesterday and my hands feel screwed today because of petrol on them. Obviously was doing it safely with a bunded fuels section and everything else like that.
Of course.
So let's move on to these tier ones and what you've done and how you've done it and what you think people can work on, because it's not just about the stories sometimes, even though I could talk shit underwater, but trying to help people out, trying to show them a different part of, you know, because they'd never get to sit down with you for an hour and say, what do I need to do with my fleet to get it onto a stage where these more upper end projects will allow it to be on with less headaches?
So we've got to a pretty good standard now, I suppose, as an industry. Like, I've been here for 8 years in Victoria, and it's 1,000% better now than it was 8 years ago. And not the quality of the equipment, but the attitude towards it and the culture towards it. Mm. People, like 8 years ago, people would argue. 5 years ago, people would do it under sufferance. Now they're going, you know what, I get it. I understand there's benefits to it. There's benefits sort of flowing into other parts of our business too. We're getting work because we're looking better. Things are faster, that sort of thing. And now that we've got to that standard, the two big things that stick out for us that if we could choose anything to improve is quality of maintenance and how that's documented. So we see particularly with road transport guys, service from old mate in a truck park for $100. Now that concerns me when we see that happen, because we go, we know what things cost. We couldn't even drive to the truck park for $100. And old mate's in this truck putting his brother or whoever's in there thinking that he's happy and he's safe. The next minute he's an Aggie dropping 2 cubes on the ring road driving up here this morning.
Yeah, I saw that actually. Traffic routed.
Yep.
There's an excavator with its arm up waiting for another truck where we lose money. But it's a challenge, and it's really difficult from the other side of the desk, let's say today, because I'm no mechanic.
Yep.
And good business is finding a cheap service. But at what point is a cheap service just like, so people might want to work with Starbucks because yes. obviously we can bring a lot. They're going to give me cheap rates.
Yes.
At what point am I meant to know when the rate's too cheap because they're using shit products, or they're not doing the full job?
That's a million-dollar question.
Yeah, and I don't fucking know, because it's been a while since I've got a crawler out, and then although in saying that I didn't really ever have crawlers because I was always on crush rock rather than on concrete, but it's been a long time since I've shimmied underneath the truck and check if they've actually greased it.
Yep.
Now, your guys actually do go underneath the truck and check it, and then when you find out that it's not greased, then it's this whole process of arguing with a mechanic then, you know, so is it... Rather than the quality of the maintenance records, is it the quality of the mechanic and the, you know, for them getting their license?
Well, that's the other part of the issue. Is it the mechanic quality's there? Is the mechanic? So we went on a bit of a side venture a couple of years ago around trucks, where we tried to get 5 or 6 mechanics as a, we'll call it them endorsed mechanics or accredited mechanics. We had a copy of the insurances, we had a copy of the trade certificates, we had a copy of all these things, so that we knew that we could send like trucks to one of these half a dozen companies, so that we knew that they'd fill checklists out and we knew that we were getting accurate information.
How did it go?
It didn't.
Oh, cool. Great business.
No trade certificates, no insurances.
Great. That's what you want. That sounds perfect.
And then we got this big black hole, then we see these invoices turn up from these mechanics now, and we're like, we know, and we've got our hands tied.
Yeah. That's a challenge in itself, because it does sound great to get in there. We've some of these projects, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've had a big chat with Denise about from COR Comply that, you know, it's really hard, some of the requirements, especially with these subcontractor fleets like the trucking mainly is.
Yes.
The compliance that you have to put forward is really, really challenging.
Well, it's paper safety, a lot of it. I think, you know, like obviously I have a lot to do with Denise, and I hear a lot of the things that she has to say, and there's things that people have to sign up to, there's things that people have to do.
I get
and it's like, what's the measurable performance increase?
Well, I don't benefit? Know if you've heard, but I have a big problem with fire extinguishers.
No, I haven't heard this, no. But I'm very keen to hear.
Yeah, the problem with fire extinguishers. I've got a problem with fire extinguishers, okay. Because there's not one person. So I've got, I don't know, 10 grand, 20 grand worth of fire extinguishers rolling around out there in Melbourne at the moment.
Yep.
I don't want one person to use them.
Okay.
Yep, they're not trained to use it.
Yep.
I don't want them to hurt themselves. I want them to safely remove themselves from the fire.
Yep.
And putting a fire extinguisher on that is incentivizing them to run over to a truck that's on fire and possibly put themselves in harm's way.
What if they're trying to get a driver out of the truck?
Very good point. Then what do you do then? Because so you are relying on them with no training to run over with a fire extinguisher, put themselves in harm's way to get the driver out of the truck, which they shouldn't really be doing anyway, but yep. I would do it myself.
Yes.
And so what do we do? Because as business owners, we're stuck. So are they on there so that they only utilised when a driver's stuck in there?
Well, I think there's a bit of awareness that needs to be created around it. It's like you don't put equipment fires out. Like
no.
You can't.
You can't.
You know, and particularly with this electric equipment that's a whole other topic. But
well, we're going to there soon.
We, Fire extinguishers, get someone out. It's for egress only. Like, it's to get out, safely get out. If you want to put something out, you have fire suppression on it.
Yeah, agreed. And I think fire suppression is great. I think it's
in
a great
some
thing.
Applications.
In some applications, I'll agree with that too. And it's not going to work in all of them.
Yep.
But well, you a bomb going off next to you ain't really good. But you know, you got your small one in the cab with you, which I would think is good. Now some sites are asking for fire extinguishers outside of the cab.
Yep.
To be mounted also. You're too close to a fire to run over to it. And
same as e-stops on tippers, same thing. You're incentivizing someone to put themselves in harm's way,
yeah,
to try and mitigate.
Because this what I get to, like where it goes, it doesn't make sense. So you've gone down and someone's put together a piece of paper that says, you know, this is great. You know, you need a stop button in the cab. No, let's take away from the stop button and just put in place a system like burst control or something like that that stops it from happening and then take away the human input from it.
Yep.
You know, a 1.5 kilo or the little tiny fire extinguisher bottles to get a guy out of the cab, I understand them. A 9 kilo fire extinguisher on the back of a digger handrail, you know, to run, climb up the tracks, climb up onto the bonnet of the machine, unlatch it while it's on fire, run back down, and then try and put out the fire. Well, if the guy's still stuck in there at that stage and,
he's in deep shit.
He is in such deep shit. Yeah. And, like, I know myself, and I reckon a lot of people listening, in that moment there, I'd lose my brain.
And you do something stupid. So there's – on a tangent, like, we have an issue with chippers.
Yeah.
And chippers have e-stops on them as well.
Yeah.
So two e-stops are a big issue for us. Sometimes they – should be used, and sometimes they shouldn't be used. But when they are used, there needs to be a very good reason for them. And with a chipper, you hit an e-stop, the thing's punching out 115 decibels, you hit the e-stop, what does it do? It doesn't shut the engine down, it just stops feeding the chipper. So if someone's getting munched in a chipper or there's something going on at the back of a chipper and you hit the e-stop, in that panic mode and that hysteria, what are you expecting it to do?
Stop.
That's right. And what happens when it doesn't stop?
I don't know.
You're probably going to go and do something stupid.
True.
So then it has to be considered the human factors of what is your intuition telling you that it should do?
Huh. And what do you think is the right outcome for here? When you hit it, the engine stop?
Has to be whatever is intuitive.
And that's not actually currently consistent?
No.
I can see that. So that's like the 4.5 kilo fire extinguisher or 9 kilo fire extinguisher that machines have and have to be tested and tagged all of the time.
Yep.
In the rare event that a guy is stuck, that would actually be beneficial for them to use, because that's the other thing. If it's engulfed in flames, like I'm talking, no, don't go near it.
Just get out.
Get out. And if there's a guy in the cab, please don't go near there. There's professionals coming. Hopefully everything will be okay.
But that being said, though, how many machines have you seen burn down how many machines have you seen burn down instantly?
Not many. I don't think they go instant. They build up, hopefully to the point that someone can get out the cab.
And typically when they do, they're machines that have got very high hours on them.
40,000 on a D9H.
Yep.
Yeah, but the doors are usually open on it because they've got no visibility anyway, so, like, you could just leg it out the side that's not on fire.
And there's another part to it as well, is you've got bigger machines where you have bigger issues. In certain environments, they should have a greater competency. Should have.
So yeah, but that doesn't happen.
You've got awareness around things.
Okay, so let's go on to electric machines, because they're coming.
They're
already, a lot are already here, you know, especially in the access space, like most of those, you know, there's a lot of small EWPs and elevator work, what do they call them, the scissors, the other ones. Yep. A lot of them are electric.
Yep.
The big ones are still diesel, I think. You'd know more than me. But there's loaders coming, diggers coming.
Trucks coming.
Trucks.
Aggies, the whole lot.
Yep. What thoughts?
Going to be a challenge. The first thing that people kick back at is, so jobs look at this as a really real risk, and anybody that knows enough about it will consider it a real risk. And it's not bias or anything such as that. It's that we haven't had it for long enough to watch enough failures to see how they fail. The other part to it as well is, and the argument that first gets kicked back is, yeah, but diesel machines burn down. Yeah, we get it, they do. But they do it in a predictable manner.
Yeah, they don't set a container ship on fire that we can't put it out and then have to leave it in the middle of the ocean.
They don't become possibly explosive. They don't come, yes, they are toxic, but at least it's a quantified level of toxicity, not a who knows what's burning in that.
Well, that the Tesla fires that happen in that container ship just show it. There's never a fire from a normal, they call them like a combustion whatever.
Yep.
There's never been a fire that they've had to do that before, really, you know, and now there's been two or something that they have to leave the boat.
Yeah, like just let it float.
Let it float on fire till the fire goes out, and now it's fucked and we need a new boat.
Yeah. Where's the insurance go?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but they actually, that shipping company or a shipping company has said they won't move EVs now because of it, because they can't put the fire out. They can put it out if it's a petrol fire or a diesel fire.
Yep.
They can't put out a battery fire.
What's the biggest concern with airlines?
I don't know.
Batteries.
Yeah, they're all asking about it now. Yep. The lithium ions.
Yep.
Yeah, you take them out of your bag. Yep. I actually lost one. I have a bit of a funny story about this. Oh, here we go. I was flying home from that part in China.
Yep.
And I had a big-ass battery pack because I used to take it so a week's worth of charge could charge an iPhone 25 times or something.
Copy.
And I'd had enough. I wanted out of that part of China. I was sick of being looked at, followed around and everything else like that. And I'd had some bad experiences with my passport, you know, and not like – so I wanted home, and I got up to the final part and they scanned my bag, took me into the room in the side and said, what's the battery pack? I'd had enough of it because I had to get permits for it because it can set off a bomb. Because
it's a big one.
Yeah. I had to get permits. So I said, here's my permit, you know, go away.
Yeah.
Then more guys with balaclavas, M16s come in, stand in the small little room like we're in now, and they're like, yeah, obviously can't speak any English, and they start like interrogating me about what I was doing with what and why I was wanting to take this 50,000 ohm or whatever the hell the measurement is battery pack on the plane. Oh, fucking no. And so I said to them, like, I don't care, I don't want it, you can put it in the bin, keep it, right? And I showed them on Google Translate. The guy then gets out his Google Translate and translates it back and turns it around and says, why do you want to put it in a government bin?
Don't put words in my mouth.
I'm like, I don't want to put it in a government bin. I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry. That's not what I meant. And then so I start at that moment pulling out all the papers from my bag, and a guy reaches over and grabs the other permit and goes, oh, here's your second permit. You're good to go. Thank you. But all, like, they're no English, no, like, I can't speak Chinese. I can barely say hello. But because it was like that, and he put his finger there and said, oh, yeah, you're good now.
Yep.
Before it was, I'm about to be locked up with no pants on.
Yep.
And now it's, yeah, you're good to fly. See you, sir. So battery packs are a thing.
They are a thing.
Yeah, they're definitely a thing. I'll never forget that moment as long as I live. So what do we do about it? Because a guy's going to run up to a fire one day with a 4.5-kilo extinguisher and want to put it out, and she ain't going to work.
Yeah, we've got a few problems there, a few things that we need to consider. And there's a few things that companies should have considered that they haven't. We looked at a fairly big bit of earth-moving equipment last year from a quite reputable European manufacturer, looking at the risks that the equipment has. So in these scenarios, we're not following a checklist. We're looking at fundamental things that we as fitters would foresee happening. What happens when you blow a hydraulic hose over a battery-powered bit of equipment?
Good question. I don't know.
How do you wash it?
I don't know. Do you have to?
Not a little while. I've been thinking about it for 12 months. I can't find a conclusion and no one can give me a solid answer.
We got to get one and try and wash it.
You can do it. I'm not.
No. Wait, does water in the water and electricity is bad, but is the electricity of the battery like, is that the connected part? I'm not even certain, or are they encased?
They're covered in labels, do not wash.
Huh. What about if I wash it with oil?
Well, that's probably a million-dollar question. Leave it covered in oil.
We need one to get covered in oil in the middle of a paddock.
Yep.
Or maybe not a paddock, in the bottom of a big hole somewhere. No, nah, bullshit, because there's a 9800 somewhere that came out electric, I'm certain of it, or a 94 or something like that.
They're trailing cable. So no, they're not batteries. Yep. Which works well, and this is probably the first step that we need to run, is that in certain environments, getting back to the theory, moving most amount of dirt, shortest period of time, for the lowest cost, where you've got a machine that's parked somewhere that's not going anywhere and you have a power supply, why don't we use mains tethered. Power? Tethered. Yep.
Well, they want to use batteries is why.
That's right. But so, why? Because we're only changing energy states, energy sources.
So you got to let them onto the job? Because at the end of the day, I know that some companies come to you and say, if it's safe and you deem it safe and you can make it safe, let's say all of those things, like because each one is slightly different than the other, we'll sign off because you're encumbered or whatever it is with the risks there that if our systems have failed and that there's an incident, we're going to come talk to CPS.
Yep.
If the systems have upheld it, and like let's say we were talking before about, you know, like finger injuries.
Yep.
What do we say? That you did it so eloquently before.
Don't stick your finger where you wouldn't stick a...
Perfect. So if we have that and some guy hurts his finger and you've got a policy written and everything else like that and he still sticks his finger in something stupid, then you can go, we need better training for them, or what training did we do? But
not,
our systems
not everything can be eliminated. That's the thing. Because somebody's... competence on a task is only as good as the state of mind on the day, which is, you know, proportional to their workload, their family life, their fucking sleep. They're all these things. So we can never eliminate everything.
So how do you and do you see these machines getting onto the jobs? Because there's some big questions to be asked about them.
There is some big questions.
Huge questions.
As it sits now, anybody that we know that is educated enough, we'll call it, for not a put down, but somebody that understands enough, you know, particularly people that have worked in underground, in coal mines, people that understand the fundamentals of preventing fire and preventing hazardous situations from coming about, just say blatant no. No, we do not know enough about these yet. We do not, we're asking the wrong questions. We're not asking, we're asking what can they do and what's the benefit. We're not asking what the failure points are.
But how are we going to get there then? Because you are actually part of...
Someone's got to make the mistake. Someone's got to make the mistakes. So as it sits right now, we know with diesel equipment and obviously we know the probabilities, not many machines burn down, and they don't burn down because they're low out, they don't burn down because they're within reason, reasonably well maintained. But when they do, it's not a big event depending on where they burn down. With electric gear, we know that the probability of it happening is much smaller, but we know that when it goes... It's going to be...
It's a much bigger problem.
Big fucking problem.
Yeah, big problem.
So somebody's going to
be no machine left.
It's going to be a roll of the dice and it's going to happen to somebody and we don't know when.
That's interesting because from the sustainability side, actually we already saw it with someone rolling the dice on a truck that caught on fire on the side of the Princes, I think it was.
Yep.
Absolutely burned to the ground. There wasn't a nut or bolt left on it, which if that was a normal fire, like I've seen lots of trucks burn, you pull the cab off, you put a new motor and wiring in it, and you keep on rolling.
Yep.
Like that chassis was pretty much melted in half. In
cactus.
That. Yeah. And so because I've had lots of discussions around electric trucks, you know, I've got sustainability goals that – electric anything will tick in a major fucking way.
Yeah.
Huge way.
Yep.
I could get one machine and smash out my, one machine out of 30 and probably smash my sustainability goals with that, because of what that, the carbon output and everything all like that, which is...
Yep.
Well, it's just being diverted somewhere else that I don't have to count towards my emissions.
But... You know, this idea behind it is, you know, it's all the power comes from renewables, which is an issue in itself, which, you know, we probably can't go there. But even if it's not, even if it does come off fossil fuel power plants, there is a benefit there.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you're running, you're making power more efficiently anyway.
Yes.
But does the cost of the change of infrastructure coupled with that offset the benefit of what you're getting in the first place? Considering that some new machines that come out, and I'll say one that sticks out is Volvos are incredibly have low emissions, to the point when we test them for emissions, we're like, is this fucking thing even working?
You're talking about their new Tier 5. They call it a Tier 5, that E-series or whatever it is. I don't know. I haven't kept up enough with the letters and numbers of every brand.
I can't remember exactly what they are.
But it's Tier 5,
yep, they call it. You look on the inside of the exhaust with 1,000 hours on it, doesn't even have any soot.
How's that work? You're the fitter. I'm the guy who digs holes.
A lot's happened since I stopped swinging spanners, Jimmy.
So... And I agree. Like since I was running C or D series cats when I first started or whatever, you know, there is no more soot coming out the exhaust anymore. Really,
so we're getting better on that.
Yeah, and then, but is the next step of that electric, or are we just taking the next step for fairly little gain?
I think we're taking it as a blanket approach. I think we need to look at where the opportunities exist within that. Better.
And what would you do?
First thing is I would look at power generation and increase our efficiency around how we generate power on sites. We look after a lot of generators, and a lot of issues with generators come from underloading.
I had I was going to buy some electric trucks for a job a couple years ago. We went through the entire process, and it ended up that we were going to have to charge them with a generator.
Yep.
Diesel one, and a big one.
It would be a big one.
Yeah, she was a big one for the fast charge. Now, that is creating power more efficiently, but it did turn out that for the three or four trucks that we were going to get, we were still going to burn, I think it was 60 litres an hour to charge them.
Yep, and how many hours a day are you charging them?
I think it was a 4 or 5 hour charge, and so you were getting about half the diesel burn.
Okay.
So there was
on an average per truck.
Yeah, but you were still burning half to three quarters of the diesel. It was half plus. Half was the best number we were going to get.
So the benefit is the benefit of it in your cost reduction in fuel or your reduction in fuel consumption offset having to have another machine.
Fuck no.
Yeah.
So it ended up being, which, like, mind you, there's more efficient ways. And if you could have plugged a fast charger into a mains, it would have been good.
Yep.
Because you could have also charged it quicker. But it ended up being that it was like, I don't want to say too much of the numbers because I can't quite remember, but I think it was $50,000 per truck per year more expensive to have with purchase price, capital investment, maintenance, blah, 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 blah. You can't take it to old mate who will service it for $100 anymore. You know, you have to buy the fast charger, you have to buy the generator, you have to buy this. Now, it also was 3 years ago. Pricing has come down since then.
Yes.
That was I was going to be a fairly early adopter for it. But I could not make that stack up.
No.
50 grand a year for, that's over 4 years, I think it was. And then, so now what's the rate have to be? You know, if you do 2,000 hours, it's $25 per hour.
What are we getting out of bed to do?
Yeah, I wanted to move dirt. It turned out that I was going to be charging, trying to save the world by plugging it into a generator that it was like an 18 cylinder generator, a big
800 kVA genset. Like we got a customer. We got a generator we look after. It's a 300 kVA generator, and there's been a few times that I've been down there. That's running a fast charge. It's got two Hyundai i20s plugged into it.
No way.
Watching this 300 kVA Cummins burning diesel at a rate off to charge these.
That'd be 20 or 30 litre. That would be that motor, I suppose.
Probably just 15, 16 litre.
Oh, so just a 15 litre. The one we were looking at, I think, was a 30 litre.
Yeah. I believe that.
To be able to charge two trucks on fast charge.
Yeah.
It just fucking ridiculous.
It can work and it will work.
I think that now, I won't get too far into it, jobs that are happening right now, but like now it's even better again.
Yeah.
And the saving is even greater and it's flipped back the other way. It does make financial sense now.
Yeah.
Not by much, but it does. And then on top of that, the sustainability sense as well.
We just need to understand that we can't have a bias with it. We've got to understand that there's going to be a failure at some point. And when we've looked at things, our opinion of it is that if you're going to use it, use it, but just don't put it anywhere when it goes up. It's going to take anything else with it.
Okay. I suppose that's a good way. Now, I reckon we've got about 5 minutes left. I always like to throw it back to you,
Roger,
for anything that you like to talk about and finish it off and wrap it off just to put you on the button.
Gotcha.
Or is there nothing? That we've covered absolutely everything you wanted to cover. I'm a great interviewer.
You are a great interviewer, Jimmy.
No, I'm getting there. I'm getting better. No, you got nothing for me.
Got nothing for you.
Oh, well, that was fucking easy then. Well, then, I suppose we can finish it up at 55 minutes anyway. I appreciate you coming in, Ben.
Thanks, mate.
Everyone will see you around on site. We have definitely changed the... You have definitely changed how we all do our compliance for sure.
Trying to.
And what's the next big thing that's going to come in, you reckon? Or you don't know?
Don't know. Centralised plant inspections. That's what we're trying to get to.
So if I inspect it through you, I can go to any project that signs up?
That's the goal.
Well, fuck, I'd like that. That'd be actually a great idea.
That's the goal.
All right. Well, you heard it here first. Centralised plant instructions, because we were from Adelaide.
South Australia.
Yeah, there we go. All right, Ben.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thank you very much. Okay. Like, comment, subscribe, all of those things. That's just done for you, Louis, at the very end. See you on the next one. Thank you.